the guy across from us shook my colleague's hand and said, "Well done, you've built a brilliant business. You should be so proud." And then he shook my hand. It's quite literally my name on the box. We had a chat afterwards and I was like, "That's why you have to be in the room. No matter what I do, I am still going to be her."
Hey, how are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, very special episode. This was a live podcast I did last month with one of my all-time favorite people and favorite guests. Chupi Sweetman returns to the podcast. We did a special on raising capital for growth. We did it with James Doody from IBI. And we talk about how do you raise capital? What do you spend it on? And why do female founders face such a massive challenge when raising and accessing capital? It's filmed in front of a live audience. We have a Q&A at the end. There's huge value in this. You hear Chupi's story about raising $3.75 million last year, how she did it, and what her plans for that money are. This is my special on raising capital for growth with Chupi Sweetman and James Doody from IBI. I'm building much more than a podcast with the Entrepreneur Experiment and have a very clear vision of what I'm trying to achieve. One of those goals was to get involved in funding Irish businesses, and I've just achieved that goal. I've joined the Quintus Capital team as a special advisor to the EIIS Innovation Fund. I spent the last couple of years getting to know the team, learning about the industry, and the time has come to join forces. The EIIS Innovation Fund has invested in several of the podcast guests you know and love already, such as Matthew and Katie from Squid and Peggy and Crowley of Brown Wellbeing, which has made the decision to join the fund a really, really simple one. EIIS Tax Relief provides significant tax refunds to investors who back Irish SMEs. However, the main issue with EIS is finding the right companies to invest in. This is where the EIS Innovation Fund comes in. It is an experienced management team to allocate your capital. They're now raising capital for November and December to deploy in 2024. If you are interested in becoming an investor, please visit EIIS.fund, so EIIS.fund, or download a copy of the online brochure in the show notes. Ever find yourself jumping from task to task? Sudden eureka moments at the weirdest hours, and you forget little details? Does that sound familiar? That might be ADHD, and ADHD Now are here to help. Their experienced clinical professionals conduct video consultations at your schedule and help you manage and understand these symptoms, turning them into your unique assets. Visit adhdnow.ie/fox and use the code FOX10 at checkout for 10% discount on your initial consultation and full assessment. I've got a massive ambition for this podcast. I want to make this the number one business podcast in the world. If I'm going to do that, I've got to be world-class on every single level. And that includes having a world-class studio, which I now have at iconic offices, The Green Room. It's an incredible space. I first recorded here with my live pod back in June, and I loved it. And get this, it's publicly bookable. That means you can go online and book it right now. As I said, it's called The Green Room. It's a private cinema and screening room. That means it's perfect to wow a client with a pitch, host a private screening, or do what I do, record a podcast here. So, as I record here, and as you know, I'm a member of Iconic Offices, I've got the team at Iconic Offices to hook us up with a number of exclusive complimentary office trials and discounts for my audience for booking this exact space. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description, grab the offer that works best for you. Thanks, Iconic Offices. Chupi, James, welcome to the pod.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome to our very special live pod here at Iconic.
That's wonderful. Well, could you think of a better location? Our own private cinema. I presume there's going to be a screening or a party afterwards.
We will have to do a screening here. People are like, what do you do here? I'm like, we record pods. We should actually watch a movie when we're finished. So welcome. We have a live audience as well, which is lovely. We're going to talk about raising capital for growth. We have two experts in the room, and I love that we've got an entrepreneur and a finance expert here as well. So we're going to get a really unique blend of what it actually takes to raise finance. So just get a quick intro for anyone not familiar, who you both are, and essentially just give us a quick intro as to why you're both here. What's the connection?
Of course. My name is Chupi Sweetman. I'm a founder of Chupi Jewelry. We're Ireland's most loved fine jewelry brand. We're based in Dublin. We sell to a global audience to 70 countries around the world. We have a company of about 250,000. And we thought at a certain stage in our business. So we're 10 years old this year. As Chupi turned 10, we knew it was time to raise funding and finance. So we built the business very much in what our financial director calls an aggressive organic model over the previous 9 years. And then we went out to raise, which is where James came in. So James is our finance fairy godfather. I was describing him as earlier, and helped us raise 3.75 million last year.
So I'm James Doody. I'm a director with IBI Corporate Finance. So we are a M&A house, advisory house. We work with a lot of kind of corporate Ireland in terms of advising around sell side transactions, buy side transactions, and of course fundraising. So that's how I met Chupi. We assisted Chupi on her fundraising.
Perfect.
Can you tell that I work in design and James works in finance?
The suit gives it away.
On the internet, no one can tell. It's fine. So bring me back to the start, right? We're going to go on a kind of a narrative arc of the whole journey. So bring me back to the start, Chupi, of how did you finance at the start? Because I think that's the question a lot of people have. We've entrepreneurs in the room who might be starting or in the early stages or even thinking about starting. How did you finance a jewelry brand, which seems expensive from the start?
I always think it's $1 million question, Gary, no pun intended. But everyone thinks that there is this magical, there's a grant, there's a loan, there's a fund, there's an investor. And actually, I think the most powerful thing instead, our job as entrepreneurs, as founders, is to not think about where does the money come from, but think about what are you doing? And why are you doing it? And so for me, that was the number one thing. I'd started my career 18 years ago working for Topshop, who I have to remind all of you were once terribly cool, no longer, sadly. But I always thought my job was making things that make people happy. So I originally worked in fast fashion. I had a quarter life crisis, quit my job, fell in love with diamonds and started making jewelry. But I thought my job at that stage was not figuring out where did the funding and finance come from, but making things that make people happy. So Chupi marks the biggest moments in people's lives. We make the ring you ask your best friend to marry you, the ring you get to celebrate graduation, the biggest moments in your life. And so at the very start, I made and we sold jewelry. I quite literally remember selling enough jewelry to be able to afford a printer. Doesn't sound terribly exciting, but a printer was kind of 200 or 300 quid. And we were working out of my spare room. I made enough jewelry. I had 200 quid. I went and bought a printer. I remember making enough money to hire our first person. And it was about 400 quid at the time a week. And I thought, okay, yeah, I can hire someone part-time. So for me, it was very much what our, as I said, our finance director calls an aggressive organic model. We made and we sold, we made, we sold, and we built and scaled in a very organic way.
And that's always the best answer for entrepreneurs is your customers.
We had no money, Gary, is the short answer.
I'm glad you got there. James, when you see, I know you're very much at the other end of the spectrum, but I'm sure you see, you know, companies at all life stages. Like, what is a good strategy for someone who just wants to get going? And I know you're very much at the top end of the funnel here, but just from everything you've seen and, you know, tracing the narrative arc back to the likes of Chupi and people who are starting, what kind of good foundational lessons would you have for people?
I think you have to get your ducks in a row from the outset in terms of making sure that you have all your materials, you have a very financial model that you can articulate, because at the end of the day, you're going to speak to investors and investors are there to try and get a return on their investment. So you need to be able to almost work backwards in some respect from what they're expecting. So, you know, are they looking for a 3x return, 3x on their money in terms of their investment? How are you going to plot that journey for them? And how are you going to give them the confidence that there's an exit for them ultimately? Because typically investors are looking for 3-year, 4-, 5-year kind of type of investment. And then ultimately they want to get a return. So I think being able to articulate that is really important. And it takes time to get that right. And that's where you need to invest the time to make sure you have your story correct.
So I like that point. Start at the end and kind of work your way backwards. And when people are trying to look forwards, how should they be charting that journey? Like in the very early stages, because let's say they're only starting from 0 or 1 or 2 years in, what should they be looking ahead to, you know, someone like Chupi to go, okay, this is where I want to go. What should they do now? You said get your ducks in a row, but how else do you mean?
So I think you need to have first and foremost, like for an entrepreneur and investors, ultimately they're going to be looking at the team. So you're going to want to make sure you have your team, you know, all of the functions that you need to have there to deliver the growth plan for the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, whatever it might be. And if there are gaps in that team, you need to be able to identify them and say, look, we might be missing a marketing person, we might be missing a salesperson, but we're raising to fill those functions and those roles. And that's what's going to deliver the return ultimately or the growth for the business. I think, you know, there's a lot of people out there that can give a lot of help. So make sure you use your network as best as you can. So speak to a lot of people, speak to people that have done it like Chupi or any other entrepreneur that has raised, because usually that's where you get the best kind of steer and best advice. I think that's really important too.
Mm. Fundraising PTSD, James.
No.
Well, it's a tough gig, I have to say, but you have to make sure that, you know, that you have the, I suppose the, you have the kind of stamina to go and kind of really do the hard yards, because you can knock on a lot of doors and get a lot of rejection ultimately at the start, but you have to make sure that you have the kind of stamina to go through that.
Mm, that's why I like doing these events, because I always think of the pod, if one person listening to the pod gets that unlock for that little piece of knowledge that helps them on the journey, that's why I think going to these physical events are so important as well, because it's a serendipitous moment. I bumped into James and actually he mentioned this. So it's so important, as you say, do the hard yards. Chibi, was this the first bit of financing you'd done?
Absolutely. So the first 9 years of the business, we'd brought in no external money.
Wow.
So we literally scaled it from quite literally our spare room. I remember moving out of the spare room. So we'd rented, I joked about a quarter life crisis, but my husband had proposed. So we'd been together since we were 16. He told me when we were 16, he was going to marry me. And I was like, don't be ridiculous. I don't want to marry you. I'm like, I'm not sure I believe in marriage. It's an archaic institution. Anyway, 10 years later, I was 26 and he proposed, and it was by a fountain at midnight in Montpellier. Like, Gary, he knocked it out of the park. And I remember wearing my engagement ring for the first time and thinking, my God, I own a piece of the future. Jewelry is literally like nothing else in the world. You know, you are choosing something one day you'll pass on to your children. I knew that day my engagement ring, my daughter would wear it. My daughter arrived 10 years later. It was another 10 years before she came. But I thought, okay, I want to do this. And we were at a point in our lives where my brother and I play this game of worst case scenario. So imagine you want to do something crazy.
Not Monopoly, worst case.
Oh yeah, no, like we're a bit vicious at Monopoly. But okay, you want to do something big and scary. What's the worst case scenario? What's going to happen if it doesn't work out? And so we went, I said to Brian, okay, I want to quit my job. I want to go train to be a goldsmith. And okay, what's the worst case scenario? And we're like, well, we lose everything. That was our worst case scenario. We were 26 and 27. And we thought, okay, well, our everything wasn't very much. We had two very scruffy rescue dogs, a rented house, and some savings that we should have been spending, as per I'm sure my family would have approved of, getting married, having babies, all those sensible things, buying a house. We thought, okay, we'll do it. So I wrote a letter. I did a kind of letter to about three or four rental houses saying, we are the perfect tenants. We're post-partying, pre-children. Rent me your house and I will pay you rent upfront for the year, but I need a 30% discount. And two of them said yes. We rented one of them, and it meant that we rented a house with one spare room. So enough room for us to live in it and one spare room to start Cheapy out of.
I love that.
And we quite literally started with this spare room. At that spare room, at one stage, there was five of us working in the spare room. And the fifth person had to lift their desk if anyone wanted to go have a pee, because their desk was across the doorway. We were literally at max capacity. And I think that's how I always thought about the business, was how can we make it stretch until we have to take the next leap? I remember saying to Brian, my husband, I was like, yeah, absolutely, we'll get an office. And at this stage, our stairway was halfway packaging. So you could only walk up the stairway sideways. So you literally had to walk sideways to get up our stairs, because all the packaging for Cheapy was all up it. And I said, I'll get an office if you can find me somewhere, exposed brick walls, wooden floors, like New York style loft, knowing there wasn't a chance in hell he was going to find it in Dublin. But he did. And so we took the next leap and moved out into our office. But that caution at every stage as we grew, because we were spending our own money, has stuck with us now, where we're still so cautious about how we grow and scale and take our risks. Mm.
And why now? Why raise now?
Great question. So I think I brought in two co-founders. So James has had the pleasure of, or the misfortune of, being stuck in a room with us several times.
Absolutely the pleasure.
But I always think as a founder, it's quite a lonely job. You know, it's you. Ultimately, your job is to grow and scale. And so I managed to convince my husband to join us 7 years in. I always say he was one of my longest hires. 7 years. Being like, you sure? You sure? Also, my number one tip, marry your CTO. Terribly useful, having the chief technology officer in the house so I can nag him over dinner. And then I brought in a very dear friend who I'd worked with through Topshop. And it means that I have two very strong co-founders who sit at a table, who hold me accountable, who lift me up, who are that peer support. And we essentially looked at what was happening in the market. I would always say data is a girl's best friend. Diamonds are very strong, but data, folks. And so we looked at the data, and there was this fascinating trend. It's super nerdy. So 80% of the fine jewelry market is currently unbranded. So that means only 20% of the fine jewelry we buy today is branded. And if you think about your water, we're sitting here with San Pellegrino, you know, almost everything you buy in the world is branded. And we thought, we're sitting here,
We've built this beautiful brand where, you know, the Irish Times calls us Ireland's most loved fine jeweler. We've built something incredible and we've built it sustainably. We've built it with ethics. We've built it with love. Let's take it global. And we knew at that stage, the only way we were going to go global was by bringing in the right partners and the right investors. And I think, James, that's what's so key for us was we weren't just looking to get married. We were looking for the right marriage.
Yeah, I think when I look back at the process that we did with Choopy, I think at the outset, it was about finding the right partner who had the same values and the same vision and matching that. And I think, you know, we spoke to, I'd say we had about a dozen type of investor type meetings where Choopy got up on her two pins and presented. And, you know, she's obviously very well versed and a very good presenter. But I think, you know, we having that vision at the outset and having those goals was very important for us, because I think where we're able to bring the value ultimately was kind of saying, well, look, we know the different types of investors and the types of kind of, I suppose, key industries or key returns or key metrics that they're looking for. So we were able to kind of match that process for Choopy, get her in front of the right people, have the right conversations at the right level. And that's ultimately... So
can you give us kind of like an idiot's guide to what it is your company would do for an entrepreneur? So if they're starting to fundraise, they get connected to you, and then what happens?
Gary, you didn't like Fairy Godfather, Finance Fairy Godfather. I thought it was great.
That's not my official term.
For anyone not familiar with James's LinkedIn, that's his full title on LinkedIn. You can endorse him tomorrow.
No, I think so someone comes in to IBI and they're looking to fundraise and we take them on, and we, you know, the way that we work, we're very much success-based. So we'll try and kind of match our vision with their vision in terms of and define success up front. And we're very upfront about that. I think... we would then, you know, look at the materials that Choopy would have or the company might have, and just critique them, because ultimately we've had lots of conversations with lots of investors, be it high net worth individuals, family offices, growth funds, debt funds, venture capital funds. They're all looking for different things. So, you know, we'll critique that. We'll give an honest view. We'll do even some work up front pro bono to say, this is what we think you're kind of need to be pitching it at. This is where we think you are in the market. These are the types of people that we think you need to be speaking to. And hopefully we have those connections to make that happen. That's ultimately what we do.
So you sit in the middle, essentially, yeah, exactly. Between the entrepreneur and all these different sources of financing.
Yeah, I think we interface with the market a lot. We kind of have I'd like to think that we have a good handle on what they're looking for. I'd like to think that we have a bit of expertise to be able to kind of shape, you know, the investors, maybe do a bit of prep work with them to make sure that their skills are honed and the messaging is honed so that it's succinct and it's cogent in terms of how it's built up.
And how do you find entrepreneurs? Because I think a lot of entrepreneurs are kind of scared about finance. They're scared about working with people like yourself. They don't know where to find you. Oh, finance is so complicated. And I think it kind of puts a lot of people off and then they retreat back. How do you find entrepreneurs and how do you find the right entrepreneurs?
That's a good question. So I think, you know, we're relationship led. So a lot of work that we do with companies comes from connections somewhere that we've done. So be it, you know, we've sold, on average, we sell between 10 and 15 companies every year. And you're talking about boards, kind of influential people, and usually they have connections. So it's a small town, Dublin, at the end of the day. So usually, you know, there's a lot of relationships there that we can leverage, or there's a lot of people that introduce work to us. And that's really important. I think in the industry that we're in, it's you're working with lawyers, you're working with tax advisors, and it's a very kind of reciprocal kind of industry as well. So if they make an introduction, you know, you usually try and make introductions back to them as well if you can. So it's a good industry in that way.
Which I think is hugely why this podcast is so important, Gary. So when our good friend, the wonderful Amy, who's CMO of Iconic.
She's called Iconic Amy in our
house. Oh, Iconic Amy.
I walked out and I was telling my wife, Michelle, I was on the phone with Amy. I just love Amy. She's great. And my wife's like, Iconic Amy. And I was like, that's her new name.
She's Iconic
she
Amy.
Is phenomenal.
So we're, you know, you and I both have worked with Amy for years. And when Amy reached out to me, I was like, oh, we should do an event in Iconic. Let's do something together. What should we do? And we'd done an incredible Women's Day one. And I was like, funding and finance. Amy, that's what I want to do. I want to talk about funding and finance because, as James said, it's relationship based. And the big challenge is that for most women in the room, they don't necessarily aren't in those rooms. They aren't getting those relationships. You know, James, I had a wonderful introduction to our incredible finance director, Donald Bulger. But without that, would I have met James? And look, I'm, you know, very privileged. I've got an incredible board who enabled that. But I said, Amy, I want to do funding and finance. And Amy was like, yes, let's do it with Gary. And that's why this conversation is so important. So whilst James, those introductions have come through the network, this is now the network. You are in the room, all of you listening, all of you in the room. This is the next round. And our job is opening that up so that that network becomes broader.
And demystifying it. I think there's so much mystery about business and finance and it all seems a bit intangible. And it's just chats like this going, tell us exactly what happened. So now let's get real. What early challenges did you have? Because this sounds like a really linear, oh, we started this and met James, it's beautiful. But what early challenges did you have? Because rarely does it just go on that arc.
How early do you want, Gary? Year one or year 10?
Go to year 10. Let's pre-James, but after you've had a bit of traction.
So I always think, you know, it sounds so linear, and especially social media is so huge. I literally have grown up on social. As I said, 250,000 people are involved in our community. I was actually laughing. I was standing here and we're doing some gorgeous events up to kids. Christmas with Kildare Village and Brian Thomas and the like. I say like, oh my God, I haven't approved a post, literally standing in the room trying to get it done. So all of those bits that, all of the bits on the road, it looks linear and perfect, but it's not. And I especially think being a woman has interesting challenges once you enter this world of funding and finance. So look, you know, Chupi is my baby, my first baby. I have a little three-year-old and Chupi. And we had an incredible reception as we walked into those rooms. I'm part of some phenomenal networks, which everyone should be part of, like the Going for Growth community, Ernst & Young's Entrepreneur of the Year, the Endeavor Program. They're amazing. And so I was walking into rooms knowing I knew the value of what we do. I love what we do. I'm so passionate about Chupi. I knew the value of what we offered. And I remember sitting in that one of our very first meeting. And I'd said to my board, when we decided we were going to fundraise, and we have an incredible board and a brilliant chair, Martin McBride. And I said, okay, guys, I'll go. I'm really happy. I'll be the person in the room. I was telling the story earlier. I'll be the person in the room, but I want to have one of you, one of the grey men in grey suits in the room with me. And they were both like, they have fierce wives and fierce daughters. You know, these are incredible men who really understand equality. And I said, guys, yeah, I'm going to have one of you in the room with me. And they're like, oh, okay, sure. You know, but I'm their CEO. They know I'm good at it. They weren't worried. And I was like, no, I'll do it with you. And the very first meeting we had as we went on our fundraising journey with Chupi, brilliant. Knocked it out of the park. You basically go in, you have a beautiful deck. You talk them through the whole plan and presentation, run the finance and numbers. Donal and I did it together. It went really well. And at the end of the meeting, the nice man, and it was always men, we did 12, James, Jesus, I would say closer to about 4,000 meetings. So I'll take your 12 under advisement. But every room we sat in, one woman in all the meetings we met, and we met multiple people because we did some work ahead of meeting James. So across 9 months, one woman was in the room.
Facing you?
Facing me on the investment side.
In total, one woman.
One incredible woman. She was bloody brilliant. But basically, yeah, there was one or two others who would have been less senior, who would have been in the rooms, not making the decisions, but in the rooms, but all men. And sat across the room, finished the presentation. The guy across from us extended his hand, shook my colleague's hand and said, well done, you've built a brilliant business. You should be so proud. And then he shook my hand. And it was one of those really interesting moments where we had a chat afterwards and I was like, that's why you have to be in the room. Because no matter what I do, I am still going to be her. And you are going to be the person they're backing. Yeah, I'm very important to the business. It's mine. It's quite literally my name on the box.
That's what I was going to say to you, though. I mean, like, it's your name. Like, it couldn't be more obvious who is behind it. What is that, though, Chupi? Why is that so ingrained?
And I really believe I have an incredible team. One of my brilliant team are here tonight. I have an amazing group of people behind me who make it possible. I'm very good at what I do, but Chupi is made possible by a brilliant group of people. But I think the challenge for that room, particularly, I'll tell you who it is afterwards. I'm not going to name and shame right now. Yeah.
Trying to rack my brain.
No, it wasn't. It was pre you. You hadn't done the introduction. Yeah, yeah.
And if you're listening online, it'll be in the show notes. If you scroll bottom, listen to right to the end of the episode, it'll be there.
Buy Gary a glass of wine and he'll tell you. But it was just that they were used to being in rooms where the finance team, where the CFOs, the CEOs were male. And so they couldn't quite wrap their heads around female-founded businesses, which, Gary, brings us to a stat that you and I both complain bitterly about. Less than 2% of money, but this is VC, venture capital in the US, goes to female-founded businesses. And that sounds quite shocking, less than 2%. Put it into human beings. That means if you're standing in the room, there are 49 men who've raised money, one woman, 49 men. That means you and your brother, if you both went out with the same business to raise money, your chance of raising, he would have 49 times more chance of raising money. And so that's the world we're operating in.
I think it's so important to put it in real terms like that, because stats kind of wash over a lot of people. Everyone's quite fatigued by stats. I think it's so important to put it into human terms.
My brother is brilliant.
You and your brother go out. I think everyone can understand that, you know, if they're brother, sister, or partner, they can understand that. How would that feel?
And it's also, my big thing is it's opportunity cost. And my brother is bloody brilliant and he runs a great business. But if we're standing in the room, I'd like to have the same opportunity as he does. And that's why someone like IBI, like James, you know, it was so important. You're basically going in, it's a pre-introduction. It's a matchmaker. We're getting married. We're looking for certain things from each other. You know, our partners in BVP, Abbey Finance and PTSB are bloody brilliant. You know, we chose them because they were the best. They got what we wanted to do. They understand what we want to achieve. I've got incredible people now sitting on my board helping us deliver that vision. But not every meeting, like I would say every meeting was glowing, not every meeting was edifying.
No, I think the meetings that we would have had, I think all very complimentary, of course, about Jupy and the vision and the business. But not every investor you're going to meet is going to be, you're not going to meet all their criteria, or it might be a particular time in their fund cycle. It might be a particular time, even if you're speaking to high net worths. They could have had a bad day, they could have had a bad week or whatever it is. So you can't beat yourself up too much if you go into a meeting and they say no. It's just wrong timing sometimes. And I think for us, you know, as you say, I think you're in the UK and we were speaking to international investors, Irish investors, and they all got it. And I guess just sometimes there's a kind of particular spark there with the investor, and there's a bit of kind of a good kind of meeting of minds in terms of on the right footing. And I think we found that in BVP and Abbey.
You've probably seen hundreds of entrepreneurs come through. What is it that you look for? The fundamentals, and then just tell me that extra piece that you're like, that's the tips over the edge. So give me the fundamentals and then just give me the extra edge.
Yeah, I think the fundamentals there, as I say, you have to have the core elements of, you know, how am I going to double, triple, quadruple this business in the next 3 years? Because that's what investors are looking for. So a steady, clear plan that you can articulate around that, I think, is the fundamental piece, right? And having that kind of confidence to be able to talk about that in a room, across from investors in the grey suits or whatever it might be. I think the extra edge comes from the team. And, you know, if you have... like I'll give you an example. So we would have been working recently, and I won't say any names, but it's a kind of a team with a very strong track record. They've done it time and time again. They've built a business, they sold it, they built another business, they've moved on. So having that track record really does give you an edge, because people recognize those names, they see them, they see their success, and they think that they can do it again. So that's really where the edge comes in. And I think a lot of people back people that have got that experience.
Mm. What are the red flags? Let's talk about the other side of things. What are the red flags that you're like, hell no?
I think, look, it's sometimes there are expectations around valuations, unrealistic. So this is where I think you need to know your audience.
And so the entrepreneur is an unrealistic valuation, Dragon's Den style. It's valued at 10 million, but we've made 10 grand. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that's a red flag. Because clearly, as I said before, you know, the way that we operate, we're kind of success-based. It's not quite no phone or fee, but we're very much aligned in terms of, you know, we'll get paid if we're successful. And we'll define success as being raise to 5 million, raise to 10 million, whatever it might be. So we're putting a bet on them as well. We need to be going into this with the same kind of mindset that we think this is what success looks like. And success means, and we'll do a bit of that work up front, say, we think this is where your company's at, this is where the valuations might be. But if they have an unrealistic expectation, I think that's a red flag for us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jupy, I'm going to get you to put on your earmuffs just for 60 seconds. What was it about Jupy that sealed the deal?
So
poor James, that's so unfair.
That's fair.
I'm going to give you a little your moment in the sun right here.
No, I think we met Jupy. I met Jupy, I think it was first on a Teams call, and she kind of pitched the business. You know, I think she had at that point maybe, you know, a good few million in terms of revenue. So a solid business plan. As I said before, the materials were all there. The team looked very impressive, and they were very impressive. So from the get-go, I think that was kind of, from our perspective, a big green tick, a green tick from our perspective. When we looked at the, you know, the... I suppose, the type of business that it is and the type of area that it's in, particularly, you know, kind of with the ESG credentials, the kind of the ethics around and behind it. I think we felt, or certainly I felt, that there was investors out there that are looking for that. So that was kind of another reason from a macro perspective, from an investor perspective, we thought that that would garner some strong interest.
What do you wish you knew now? What do you wish you knew at the very start? Before this, before you started raising any money, what was the couple of things you were like, oh, this would have saved me months, or I wish I'd known this?
I don't believe in regrets, Gary. So that's kind of, I'm not a good person there. I really think you know what you know now, and you know, you have the knowledge you have when you entered the room.
What surprised you?
I think the kind of biggest thing was how simple it was. I felt that was the con.
I was not expecting you to say that.
Like, genuinely, it literally, you know, it is that simple. Like, it's bloody hard work. Like, James, we went, you know, we did a long process. We closed our deal on equity on the 21st of December and debt on the 23rd of December. So, like, when I say, I have one picture of Brian and I sitting on the couch the day we've closed, and it's about 7 p.m. We look like it never made the internet. We are broken. It took everything, you know, and the same on our investor side. Like, they were equally, everyone was exhausted. There was no glass of wine. We didn't manage anything. We were so tired at the end of it. But how basically simple it is. You know, you have your brilliant team, you have your plan, you have your beautiful deck detailing your plan, and you have your financial model, and that's it. That's really all you're doing, is those two things. You have your brilliant business, you build a deck and you build a plan, and that's what it takes. And you need very good people. And I think, you know, that's, James is saying, you know, your brilliant team. Maybe you don't have the brilliant team yet. Certainly we have, in some areas, a very exceptional team. There's other areas where we need, you know, we have key recruits we'd like to do, but it's your network and the people that go with you, having those people around you. I was very lucky going through the process. I had our amazing chair. I had our amazing finance director. I had James. So I had sort of like the fairy godfathers.
I think all those elements that made that judgment pretty quickly to say those elements are all there. And that was kind of, I think that was important from our perspective. And obviously the brand itself was something that we resonated. And Chubby probably doesn't know this, but we would have done our own kind of sound checks as well, just to say, do you know Chubby? Do you know the brand and things like that? So it was clearly a brand that resonated. So I think from that perspective, that gave us a lot of comfort too.
Mm.
And that, you know, I always think that it's so mystified in a way, you know, even the language that goes with it. Good Lord, I did feel I took an MBA in fundraising. Like, I literally, James, like, I'd be like, and what's that acronym? And what are we saying now? And what does this mean? And all of that knowledge, definitely the second time we raise, is embedded and will be so much easier. But really leaning into people and just being like, yeah, this is totally doable. And I, to be fair, that is my attitude to life. I'm like, you want to do the thing. And that's my mum. 100%. We were brought up with, you want to do the thing, you do the thing. And so I think my big thing now is demystifying it for others, because our job is changing the world. Our job is, we have little girls, gorgeous little boys, all those children. We want the future to look better and brighter for them. We've got a job in terms of disrupting that, to ensure that the capital and the money of the world gets into the hands of businesses you care about better.
Did you have a plan for what you wanted to do with the money? Because obviously it's raising capital for growth. What was the growth plan?
Did we have a plan, Gary?
Clearly, it slides in a beautiful folder you give James. But apart from that,
I would like to say we had the most beautiful deck James had ever seen. Thank you very much.
Oh, totally.
You're meant to agree, James.
Absolutely. I think that was every slide was designed perfectly.
Yeah, and you need that. No, we had a really clear plan, so we knew what we wanted to do. So we went to go and change the world. So a huge part of that was retail. So we have built a beautiful business right to 70 countries around the world through online. And we knew that the next stage for us was retail. So it was opening a flagship store. So we went out in January, all, you know, cocky, closed the raise. We're going to open a store. Yeah, if, you know, anyone who's been through the Irish property market, it's bad on the residential side. You should try the commercials. That was a whole ball game. So we eventually signed a lease in May and then opened a beautiful store on Clarendon Street, 4,500 square feet across two floors in what's known as the Diamond Quarter. So basically, literally as you...
Did you call it that?
How did you know? It's known as Jewelry Alley, which is so unsexy. So Diamond Quarter is so much better. It's called the Jewelry Quarter. We're going for
that
Diamond Quarter.
It's that branding piece, James. Yeah. See, it's all making sense.
You don't
now.
Want Jewelry Quarter when you can have Diamond Quarter.
Diamond Quarter.
And it's literally, you're on Grafton Street and you look down what's Johnson's Court, known as Jewelry Alley or Diamond Alley, and you see there we are. And so that was a huge part of it, was opening that beautiful store. And then we launched into Brand Thomas, which has been really exciting, with the amazing team down in Cork. So rolling out retail. was a huge thing for us. We've got some really big tech projects we want to invest in around blockchain and around how that works and bringing sustainability out of the intangible into the tangible. But really this year, if I had to define 2023, it was open the damn store.
And it looks wonderful. James, what are companies raising for? So Chibi has given us her answer there, but what she wanted it for. What are companies typically raising capital for?
Yeah, they're raising capital for building out functions or building out teams or investing in facilities, whatever. It depends on industry, really, at the end of the day. I think a lot of, so I cast my mind back now to some of the recent fundraisers that we've seen come in the door, for example. Some of them even start out as we're looking to raise capital to, there might be a shareholder that they're looking to refinance out, or they're looking to step away from the business. So that could be effectively a secondary type capital. So it's not primary capital in terms of money onto the balance sheet of the company. So that would be a specific or a special situation where you're looking to basically finance out somebody because there might be at the end of the road in terms of what they want to do in the company. But most financing that we do is kind of growth focused. So it's investment onto the balance sheet for a particular reason. And I think you asked Jupy there around, well, did you have a plan in terms of what the money was going to be spent on? Well, you'd want to have a plan going into the room for sure, because you want to have clear vision on where you're going to spend that money, because it's going to be, I suppose, challenged. It's going to be due diligence. It's going to be kicked around a little bit. So you're going to be challenged on that, and you need to be very clear on how that's going to be spent.
Held upside down and shaken would be my phrase.
Exactly. Now we're getting into it. So you finished December
23, 22.
We live in a very different world now. James, what's the last kind of like, since you've been raised, what has the financing world been like?
Yeah, I think it's changed a lot, certainly for private equity. So a lot of deals that would have been done in the recent past, in the last 18 months, you know, there was kind of financial engineering around debt, right? And we all know that interest rates have gone up, and that kind of plays with the economics of how much a private equity firm might be able to buy a business for example. Fundraising, we know the tech industry is probably, you know, coming back from maybe 2 years ago. Valuations have come back a small bit. There's probably been a few companies, high profile companies, that have gone against the wall. So people are a little bit more nervous about that. But that's not to say that deals aren't getting done. Still good companies are still attracting capital, because there's still a big wall of capital out there that's looking for a home. And I think people are just a bit more careful about how they allocate that. So I think deals are taking a little bit longer to get done. People are spending more time, you know, poring over the numbers, analyzing where the pitfalls might be, and really saying, tell me again how you're going to deliver a return for my investment. And that's kind of where we see things at the moment. The deals are just taking a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. People are pausing for thought and just being a little bit more cautious.
Mm. And for you, Chupi, then, I know you're deploying the capital in 2023. You mentioned some of the challenges there about the commercial space. Has there been anything else you're like, oof, I thought raising the money was it. I thought that was the end goal.
Good Lord, Gary. Like, if we had to look back.
There is an easy one. I've just thrown that up in the air for you.
Yeah. Like, if you think about the, you know, of all the ways we all expected the last few years to go, my sister is an economist and with the World Bank, actually currently just with the Norwegian Refugee Council, she's trying to pay back all of her times in the bank. So having worked for the devil, she's now going to try to do something good. But she said to me when I was little, so she's a big Chinese specialist. That's her area of expertise. And there's a Chinese curse that may you live in interesting times. And she'd say it to me when I was bored, you know, be like a teenager, be like, I'm bored. And she'd say, may you live in, and I couldn't understand why someone wouldn't want to live in interesting times. Yeah. Like, surely everyone wants to live in interesting times. Having done nearly 4 years of interesting times, I would really like a dull year. Just a year without, if you think we've had, we've had a pandemic, that was enough to be getting on with. We've had a war, a second war. We've had inflation. We've had all the challenges. So I definitely feel it's been a roller coaster a few years for us in the business, for indeed everyone in, you know, you can feel it. The world is moving underneath us. And yet there are things that are still so true. Like, we would say we're in the business of love, hope and everything in between. We're there. You know, you get the day you fall in love, the day you get married, the day you get divorced. All of those things happen, no matter what's going on in the economy, no matter what's going on in the world. So those incredible moments. I've had a few days of, since we've opened our beautiful store on Clarendon Street, had a few days being on the shop floor. And I'm like, a child. It's like being a kid in a sweet shop at Christmas and getting to meet people who are kind of marking these huge moments, no matter what the world is going on outside. You know, there was a couple in earlier choosing their engagement ring and they were so embarrassed because, you know, they didn't want anyone to see them and it was a secret and just like the privilege of doing that. So I think I'm really privileged because one question you will get asked again and again when you're raising is, what's your exit? When are you leaving? And I kept getting kind of fierce side eye being like, you know, are you going to stay? Like, folks, my name is on the box. Like, I'm not going anywhere. You know, you're going to have to. And always, I think for me, I always think I've talked to you about this before, Gary, but I have a personal board. So, you know, I have an incredible corporate board in Chupi. And I have an amazing personal board of about 7 brilliant women, including Sonia Lennon. I know Sonia won't mind me naming her, who were across our 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s. And it's such a privilege. And I would recommend anyone, you can curate it yourself. You bring together a group of people from different industries, entrepreneurs. And basically, it helps you think, not what am I doing today or what am I doing tomorrow, but what does 10 years look like? So actually, the first time I ever walked into the room with them, this was a group of women I had never met in my entire life, bar one of them was a friend. And we had to write the perfect day in our life when we were 65 and our own obituary. It's like, wow. Whoa. I was like, okay, but it was incredible. Having to dial out of today and be like, yes, it's been a roller coaster a few years for all of us, but it's also had extreme moments of joy and of hope and all the bits in between. So I think focusing on that longer term picture, and I love what I do at Chupi. I'm going to be here for at least the next 10 years. I actually ask my chair every year, I'm like, am I the right CEO? Do you want a different one? You know, and I check in with them because my job is, you know, I'm the founder, yes, but we could hire a different CEO. And every year he tells me yes. So as long as he tells me yes, I'll be here.
I'm going to have to ask you what a personal board is and how it works. I'm a planning nerd. My accountability buddy James is in the audience. We meet every quarter. We have a full day of planning, looking ahead. So powerful. And since I started doing it, my whole perspective has changed. 10 years, 5 years, 3 years, one year, quarters. I'm breaking it down into the day. Personal board. Give us the insight on that. How does that work? How do you put it together?
So I got invited on. We're an incredible mix of, so it's a really interesting mix, entrepreneurs, and it means that you've different perspectives and different generations. So brilliant. Like what you're doing with James is incredible, that quarterly piece. What the difference is in having a board, we meet once a quarter. We do 2 day away. Shamefully missed our last one. If they're listening, I'm very sorry. We all missed it though, so it wasn't so bad. And you do, and we sit and work. So we go away to a beautiful hotel, 9 to 6 in the room. Everyone presents their big challenge and big opportunity for the quarter. And then you are held to account. You're okay. What are you working on? How's it going? And it's personal and professional. So what we do, and I think women particularly, and you know, because by and large the burden of childcare and you know having the babies falls to women, so it means that we've got this incredible blend of both moments in our lives. And you look at, like I said, you know, those exercises, big picture exercises has come up. What's your perfect day in your life at 65? And you write it down. And then why is it so different from today? If your perfect day in your life is living on an island off the coast of Kerry, what are you doing living in Dublin city centre? And how can you get there faster? How can you get a job that enables remote? How can you, and you ask yourself all those questions and then set out the plans and agenda. And the next time you meet, you're there. And obviously a WhatsApp group that goes with it. And it's such a powerful thing because I think I was homeschooled and I always think, hasten to point out, not from the Burke school of thought, like I believe in evolution and the right to choose and all of the terrifying things that are going on down there, but really with the idea that relationships are generational. You know, I think one of the challenges of school is we become friends with people who are like us, who are 1 year older or 1 year younger. And so our network becomes very homogenous. It's the same type of people who sit in our world. And what's amazing about a board is that you expand and you grow in the same way a corporate board. And so we're going to invite someone new on. It's very exciting. It's like a date. We've got our eye on someone and we're going to invite them in and hopefully they want to join us. And
is there a secret handshake and then they have to learn and they get like a mysterious ring in the night?
We have a lot of Sonia's clothes and a lot of my jewelry, but we need a secret handshake. I'm gonna propose that at next meeting.
Memo to the board. James, Chupi mentioned it there, networking and relationship building. People are very transactional sometimes about it. Chupi's one of the best people I've ever met in terms of networking in a real way, in a relationships way. And I love the way you blend the personal and the business. A lot of people divorce them. How do you approach networking and how do you advise entrepreneurs to approach relationship building? So really that's what it is.
Yeah, I think there's no shortage of events to go to in Dublin. I think you can find yourself going to a lot of events and kind of attending, and you can sometimes see the people that are standing at the door, the entry point, because that's where you're going to see the most people coming in and out. That's an old strategy, everyone knows. But in terms of networking, I think just get out there and don't be shy and just have the conversation, because everyone going into a room to network is there to kind of chat and be open. And I think that's always a good way. I think, you know, using your own network and people that have done it, you'd be surprised at how many people are willing to give you advice, point you in the right direction if you just reach out and ask, particularly people that have done it before. Like, I'm amazed a lot of people, like, just for example, just coming onto this podcast, the amount of people that have reached out to me. And, you know, I've had calls already and I've said, look, you know, it might not be an opportunity for us, but I can certainly point you in the right direction. So I think kind of making that first step in terms of just asking somebody for some assistance is always the first hurdle or the first challenge that you have to get over. And being in there and being able to kind of, you know, take that first step is important.
Mm. I'm most fascinated by that, James. So every presentation I do, and I'll update you with the numbers. So I'm doing a talk for Image Magazine at the end of the month, which will be really fun. And it's about 200 people. And I'll put my email address up at the end of the slides and be like, guys, you know, if I can help anyone with anything, reach out to me. And if I get over 5 people, it would be, I'll buy you lunch. I'll buy you dinner. I'll buy you lunch anyway. But I'm always amazed by how rarely people are confident of going, yeah, actually, I'd love your help.
Why is that?
I think the challenge, so you and I both know, like, networking, one of the big problems is it's transactional. Mm. By and large, people are, you know, like, don't give me your business card. You know where it's going to end up. It's going to end up at the bottom of my bag. I'm going to lose it. I'm never going to look at it again. And so much of it is literally just like business card tag. But that idea of actually building genuine relationships, of doing that. So I think, you know, it's so shallow. Most of it is like, oh, hi, I'm this, I do that, I do this. Like, that's not, you know, does that connect to me? Does it mean anything? And people aren't understanding that actually it's about, like, networking is such a dirty word. Building connection, building community, like all of those, you know, think about what you do within the podcast with Entrepreneur Experience. It's all about community. It's all about connection. I was chatting to John earlier, who we'd had a gorgeous dinner with you, you know, all of those moments, those are the connections we build. And getting out of it being transactional and getting it to be like, I'd love to, you know, like, I'm like, people are like, oh, I'd love half an hour of your time. Let me buy you lunch. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's really nice. I'll do it. Honestly, it happens twice a year. Really? And I always think
you're about to get inundated.
Oh no. Like, so I have days in my calendar. So I'm actually involved in this. So I set aside give back days in my calendar. I like everything measured. So I have about 10 give back days in my calendar. So 10 full days, normally split across half days. And I do my not-for-profit work. So I do anything that involves giving back. So I'm involved in a phenomenal program called Going for Growth. So it's a female entrepreneurship program. Amazing, amazing program for female entrepreneurs who want to build businesses of scale.
So many of my guests have come through it. It is...
Oh, it's like a cult.
I only hear good things. Yeah. Oh, that's where they're coming from.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it's a cult.
Now I understand.
So many women in business have done it because it's an amazing thing. So basically, I did it back in 2015. And the goal of the program is co-funded by KPMG and our good friends in Enterprise Ireland. And it means that basically it's for women who want to build businesses of scale. So the data is terrifying when you look at this. So there's a big European study run every few years, and 10 years ago it said for every one woman who wanted to start a business at scale, and that's measured as 10 employees and €1 million in revenue, so not enormous but big enough, every one woman, 9.5 men. That doesn't mean women are less brilliant. It doesn't mean women start bad businesses. It just means one woman, 9.5 men starting those businesses at scale. So Going for Growth, we now see one woman, 4.5 men. So still a man is 4.5 times more likely to start a bigger business. So she's starting a business, but she doesn't have an example of how she'll build and scale. So when I did the program, and I tell this story all the time, when I did the program, you had to write your ambition, like for what you want to do in kind of 5 years time. And that was 2015. So I was writing my application in 2014. We just started, we were a year old. And I put down €1 million because it was the biggest number I could think of. I genuinely couldn't think of a bigger number. I would have, the idea of writing 10, like I just wouldn't have had it in me. Did the program, wrote 10, you know, and that was it. But those kind of programs, those kind of networks are much more, so Going for Growth, I get like 100 emails from Going for Growth because we're already in a safe place. I get so many requests for coffees, for lunches, for, you know, and that's so powerful. But cold ones, or ones when I've spoken to an audience or a group who've all come to hear me, no, everyone is that little bit more shy, that little bit more nervous. Like James, you know, if you think about the opportunity to come in here to have 5 minutes of his time,
yeah,
it's so huge, your time. And to offer
thanks,
something.
Julie.
Yeah, no.
James, when you meet entrepreneurs and you build relationships with them, like, I know it's a difficult question, how long is a piece of string? Typically, how long can a funding take from start to finish? It depends on the amount and the industry, I'm sure. But, yeah, you know, bring us through just a whistle-stop tour of what a funding process looks like.
I love that question because it is a piece, how long, yeah, is a piece of string kind of type question. So typically, you know, you somebody comes into our office, maybe we'll have a chat, a meeting with them. They'll kind of pitch their business to us in a way. They'll talk about their ambitions and what they're looking to do. We'll usually ask for some information, some further follow-up information. That's where you kind of share an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. They'll maybe send you their financial model, their pitch deck, whatever else, the materials that they have. We'll critique them. We'll analyze them ourselves internally. We'll maybe do some, you know, kind of valuation work. And we'll play back our thoughts. And sometimes they might not like to hear what we have to say, but we'll do our best and we'll give our view. And that's what we're ultimately there for. So that's kind of this kind of, and if there's a meeting of minds after that, and we're kind of minded to maybe send them some terms in terms of how we might go about the process, including the materials, here's a timeline that we envisage. So usually we kind of say, look, this could take 3 months, it could take 6 months. That's the kind of time frame, because
we were six.
Six.
You can use us as an example, James. Yeah. James is the king of discretion. So he's like, he won't give a thing away, but we were 6 months.
Yeah, there were 6 months, I think. So, like, I mean, it really is dependent on, you know, the level of engagement you get up front. You could have somebody that says, yeah, absolutely, great opportunity. Where do I sign? Great, fantastic. That's not the way it always works. So, and then at the back end of a process, so usually the front end, you're kind of preparing those materials, you're going out, you're meeting investors, you're creating those meetings, or you're scheduling those meetings, and you're in kind of pitch mode. So you're in the market. And then you're kind of asking, or you're soliciting kind of term sheets. So you might spend...
What's a term sheet for anyone not familiar?
Yeah, so a term sheet might be, what terms are you willing to invest in this company? So it'll have, you know, money, what's the instrument that you're going to use? Are you using debt? Are you using a preference share? Are you using ordinary shares? And there's all sorts of kind of different reasons around why you might use one or the other. Obviously, debt is obviously a different instrument. So, you know, you're looking at all the different terms. What kind of protections are they seeking as part of their investment? Do they want to be on the board? Do they want to be? So there's all sorts of different things that you get into when you're running a process. I think then, you know, once you have terms, you kind of want to assess those terms. Obviously, you want to make sure you're happy with them. And then once you do, you know, you're probably going to select a preferred party. And that's where you get into exclusivity usually, because they're going to spend some time. They're going to incur cost. They're going to spend maybe 8 weeks doing due diligence on the company. That's when you really open the books, and you start to get really probing questions. And that's probably the most uncomfortable part of it. And then that takes time. And then you have to paper the deal as well. So you have to have the legal elements of it. You have two legal advisors. And for anyone out there that knows, when you get two legal kind of firms in a room, you know, they can fight over full stops. So, you know, that's it does take time. You need to be patient, but that's the reality.
And that's what jobs hear, right? You kind of hear about these deals. It was so hard. It took so long. But it's great to break it down like that, I think, to kind of understand. Because looking the outside in, people just see when there are times. They're like, oh, unreal. They don't see those months.
And I think what I didn't understand, and you did ask me this, and I didn't have, was how much. So due diligence is, all it means is that you literally open up the car bonnet and everything is up for grabs. And that's fine, because we had nothing to hide. You know, we were really transparent in all of our documents. We knew exactly what we were doing, but it's the producing the documents. We produced reams and reams and reams, and it was getting all of that. And it's so important for the other party coming in, because they're trusting you. You know, they are literally entrusting you with their fund, in whatever way, you know, they're with their money ultimately, no matter where the money is coming from. And so that process of just moving through it, and it's all the little kinks and things. You're like, oh, we do that like that because actually that makes sense. And they're like, oh dear God, can you document that? And then suddenly you're producing a 10-page deck. Right. So I think the volume of work there, is to not underestimate. Essentially, I was lost to the business for about 3 months, I would say. And, you know, that was, I was never happier than when I returned to my job. I was like, woohoo! And that's huge. And having a team can do that.
You can't underestimate how distracting it is. And this is where sometimes you see, like, one of the things that I see investors making a judgment on is, well, are you raising enough? Because if you're not raising enough and you're going to be back doing this for 6 months again in 12 months time, your head's not in the business. You're not focused on the strategic goals of the business, and that's a huge distraction. So that's another kind of, I suppose, you can't underestimate how much work goes into it. It's huge.
So you're able to steer people through and go, maybe that should be 5 or maybe that should be 10, depending on what you see from your experience.
Yeah, I think generally, like, you'd want to be raising enough to give you, like, it depends. Every situation is different.
Of course,
But I think generally speaking, you know, you want to give yourself enough runway to allow you to achieve those midterm goals that you have set for yourself. Otherwise, you'd be back out in the market again, doing 6 months, taking questions, you know, so that's important.
What do you see trip up deals?
What trips up deals? I guess, you know, There's no one reason, or there's no kind of key thing jumping out to mind, but I think when you get into due diligence and you see that the numbers aren't quite where they were pitched at, when you get under the bonnet, as Chupi says, you can see, like, corporate financiers like us, you know, we can do all sorts of clever add backs to the numbers and say, look, this is what the run rate looks like, this is what the financial projections look like, here are the assumptions. But when somebody gets in under the hood and spends a lot of time, they can really challenge that and say, well, look, what we see now is not what we thought we saw at the outset. We want to recut the terms of the deal. And that's
right.
Where I see deals kind of fall over, because expectations weren't met.
And I'm sure, like Chupi mentioned earlier, the world can change in a second now, and it always has, but it just feels magnified at the minute. Like, does that impact deals?
Absolutely. So I've got scenarios where, you know, you go out, you know, you could be selling a company, you could be raising finance, whatever it might be. And the fundamental economics around what you're selling or the market that you're in could be completely changed. Be it retail industry where inflation has had an impact, or whether it's a tech company where, you know, the pace at which interest rate rises have come and the valuations have been impacted. There's a number of things. It can work both ways. It can be a positive thing too. The market can turn in your favor, and you can go back and renegotiate as well. So that's important too. We've had instances of that as well. So it's not just a one way street. And I think some companies, some markets in this current market are doing better than others, and are doing better. So as I say, it's a two way street.
We're just about to come to our questions from the audience now. Chupi, what would be your final piece of advice to people setting out on the raising capital journey?
Start with your business. What are you doing? Why are you doing it? And why should someone care? I think we're so obsessed with what we do, you know, entrepreneurs, founders, we think what we're doing is brilliant. But I really think dialing it back to, does someone actually want it? Does your auntie want it? Great. Does your cousin want it? Wonderful. Your mom, your brother, all that. But actually figuring out, have you got something that solves a problem? Is it genuinely going to make a difference? And being really clear that you are heading down a huge road. Entrepreneurship is wonderful. It's such a privilege, but equally it's a huge challenge. And going, okay, are we going to do this? Am I going to give this? Like, I called GP my first child, because it is my first, you know, it has taken blood, sweat and tears to mind it and bring it into the world and grow it. And there's still so much to do. I wouldn't do anything else, but you've got to adore it. And you've got to make sure, you know, it's the question I always ask when I start designing any collection for GP. I don't start with what. We don't need a ring. We need something that is going to tell the person you love most in the whole world that you want to spend the rest of your life with them. And that's my job. That's our job at Chupi. And so asking yourself those questions before you go down the rabbit hole and end up in 5 years' time going, was this actually what I wanted? Did I sign up for this? Was this part of the plan? So being really crystal clear, it's what you want.
I'm going to steal one more extra question before I come to James. We both have little girls, and you mentioned earlier about changing the world and making it better for them to come into, as, let's say, they both want to be entrepreneurs. What can we do now on a tangible basis to make it that a little bit better?
I think our huge opportunity is around equality. I think the huge piece is, you know, when I think of, my mum was one of the founders of the women's movement, burning her bra outside the door and changing the world. And yet still, we are so far from it. One female entrepreneur for every 4.5 men, less than 2% of capital to female founders. There's such huge challenges. And if I think about the world I want to live in, I want to live in one where there is real equality. And so I think our job is to back businesses that are doing that, back people that are doing it, back ourselves and believe in change. Like, you know, Gary, I know for you, it's such a huge thing for Entrepreneur Experience to feature female founders, to have that space. We have a whole opportunity. And I always think, is she conscious of female founders? That's one piece of diversity in the room and one change. And that's my heartless economist hat back on. Opportunity cost. What are we missing out on by not having that diversity in the room, by not having other people in the room, by not changing the world? Because we all look at things very differently. So I think heart, let's change the world so our little girls grow up in the same way that they have equality, and our little boys that they have the world they want. But equally, heartless economists, look at the opportunity. Imagine how incredible Ireland could be if we had the same, if we'd entrepreneurship in our DNA, because we have it. We just need to back it.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. James, what would your advice be? You kind of touched on this a little bit earlier to founders setting out in the journey. Maybe they're just thinking about, right, you know, business is going well. I need to speak to someone like James. What would your advice be to just before they come to you? Yeah, I know you said get the plan, get the team. What do you, would you love to see coming across your desk?
You'd love to see a kind of, and this is me being the finance hat on, you know, you'd love to see a kind of a financial model with a clear articulation of the assumptions and where the growth is going to come from. As I said before, you're usually raising finance for growth. And if you have a well thought through plan from the outset, it cuts a lot of work out from our perspective, brutally, because we can step into that shoe. We can kind of sit down with the founder, spend time with them to develop that plan. But if somebody comes with that plan in place and you, where the real value add is kind of connecting you with the right investors, connecting you with the right people, and we can spend more time doing that, well, then I think that's important from our perspective. But yeah, somebody that has a plan, like again, just using Jupy as the example, we had Donald Bulger from BLG, and that was a kind of well thought out financial plan that was put in place, the Excel file, P&L, balance sheet, cash flow, all articulated, because the types of investors that we were speaking to, for example, if you think about EWIS, it's kind of 4-year structured money. So you want to have a really clear cash flow, because what they're looking for on the downside scenario is, well, after 4 years, can I get my money back, or can the company refinance me? So you want to make sure that you have that in, you know, that kind of pathway drawn out. So from my perspective, when I see an entrepreneur come in, if they have a really clear financial plan, a really clear kind of materials around all of that, that's really important.
Beautiful.
Can I have one more, Gary? I think my big last tip would be, it's like getting married. You know, I joke about that, but it is ultimately, you know, who we ended up to be getting married to, in our colleagues in BVP and Abbey Finance and PTSB. They were the most difficult meetings. I remember walking out of them being like, drained. It's like, good God, James, I'm shook. But because they were the best questions, because they were the best partnerships. And now, you know, we're in the details, we're married, you know, we are now in this together. And having people with you on the journey who are there on good days and bad days, for better and worse, that's the important one. Like, we had some lovely offers, some glorious, you know, like, we're going to be amazing and everything wonderful. But I knew sitting in the room, I was like, I really like you, but I'm not going to be able to work with you. What's it going to look like on bad days and good days? And so that, like every partnership, every relationship, there are days where it doesn't work. There are days when it's tough. And really, in every relationship you build in your business, whether it's your board, and I would be a huge advocate on building a board you can't afford long before you have a proper board. So my chair was my coffee date. Long before I could afford to have him as my chair, I took him for coffees. I eventually extended to lunches. And then we brought him on as our chair. And having that relationship, you know, those depth that you can pick up the phone and have those conversations, that's where it comes down to. So whether you're on the path to funding and finance or funding it, or whether you're still early days, build relationships with people.
Choose hard now for easy later. Beautiful. Do we have questions from the audience?
We went at least one really difficult one.
We already told you the questions were coming. James, thank you. I'll repeat them for the audio as well. So what's the biggest pivot you've done over the last couple of years?
Ooh, great question. At one stage, I thought if I heard that word again, I would throw up. I'm sure everyone who survived 2020 in business is aware of the word pivot. And I had my little girl in COVID to add to the level of entertainment. The biggest one for me was 2016. So I said, daughter of an economist. That means doom is the family game. So we spend our lives looking at the next recession and literally being like, when do you think the next recession is going to be? In 2016, was in the UK. It was, my dad and sister are English and are in London. My mom and brother are here. And I remember was there as the Brexit vote, literally there as the Brexit vote happened. Then you remember that wonderful year Trump also got voted in. And I remember we just signed a couple of really big deals. Tupi at that stage was gold-plated sterling silver. We were payday treat, kind of between 100 and 400 quid. And I thought, oh gosh, I've built the wrong business, because I got into jewelry to mark the biggest moments in people's lives. Didn't have diamond money. So very much started, you know, our affordable luxury brand, and thought, okay, if we are looking at a recession and deglobalization, and if we're looking at all the challenges that this is going to bring, then we're not going to survive, because I'd built a business that was sold through other stores. So it was sold through some incredible partners across UK and Ireland. We were Macy's and in the US. This is wrong. So I basically took my baby and went, what do we do really well? We are really good at storytelling. It's in our DNA. We're really good at community. We had an incredible community. We're really good at making beautiful things that people really adore. And we're really good at technology. At that stage, Brian was my what we call a fractional CTO, also known as the man I nagged at the kitchen table. And I thought, okay, what can we do? So we took Tupi and basically burnt to the ground a beautiful business and built another one from the ashes. So we built a solid gold brand. So we 5x'd our average order value over 5 years. So went from an average order value of about 117 to an average order value of about 760, and built a solid gold brand. And that was the biggest change. So by 2020, we were solid gold and diamonds. And that was incredibly tough. You know, we'd started a business, we built a business, we kind of knew what we were doing, but we knew it wasn't going to be forever. And it wasn't going to survive the upcoming tornado, and it wouldn't have when COVID hit, and we would have been dependent on all of that wholesale. So yeah, that was huge. It was an incredible roller coaster though. I loved it.
So for pre-trading, do you look at companies like that, or should they look at something like crowdfunding?
So typically IBI, as I said, we're very much relationship led, but we usually step in for the kind of the first institutional round, right? So that usually isn't a pre-trading company.
What's an institutional round?
Might be a venture capital or private equity firm, or even a family office, for example, that do kind of investing as a professional element of what they do. And based on my experience, I think, you know, pre-trading or pre-revenue businesses, usually it is friends and family that get you to that first kind of...
James, would you talk to my friends and family and see if they'd lend?
Yeah, that's a tough one. No, but I think, you know, usually it is kind of angel investors. It's friends, family, and maybe a bit of crowdfunding, as you say. You know, institutions and the VC community do have typical hard metrics that they look at, be it 1 million of annual recurring revenue if you're a tech company, for example, before they'll even kind of entertain the conversation. Now, there are exceptions to the rule, of course, but that's typically how the market kind of segregates itself. If I look at the spectrum of kind of capital and the pools of capital that are out there, yeah, at the one end, you kind of have high net worth individuals. Of course, you have the likes of EI and Enterprise Ireland and all those that are very supportive, but you have high net worth individuals and thankfully, in Ireland, there's a lot more of them because Ireland's done very well. And, you know, people have set up businesses, they've grown them, they've internationalized them, and they've sold them, and they've got capital that they're looking to, you know, manage. And if you have access to some of those high net worth individuals, particularly if you're in an industry that they know well and they see the opportunity just as well as you see the opportunity, well, then that's a happy hunting ground, I think, to have those conversations. But from our perspective, usually it's the first institutional round with a kind of professional investor.
Perfect. Your second bit. Sorry.
I've got a plug, Gary, for... So I lead on a program called Starting Strong. That's part of Going for Growth. It is designed for businesses that are pre-revenue under 2 years old. You can be pre-revenue or revenue. It's free. I give my time to it for free. There's incredible people who come through it. I've had some phenomenal Riley,
yes,
the amazing guys, Fox's Bow, some incredible businesses that have come through it and are phenomenal. It's an amazing place to start. There's some amazing, it's female, unfortunately, folks, but amazing program and really worth considering.
So is it fear or lack of confidence that holds people back, and especially women in certain business scenarios?
And yeah, I think it's really interesting. So the ticket sold out in 20 minutes, and yet I'd say the room is only 2/3 full, which is people wanted to be here, but they couldn't quite get into the room. I think the big challenge, and what you see in things like the GEM study, like if you look at equality studies, is around if you can't see it, you can't be it. So I sit in some phenomenal networks. One I'm in particular, 250 people, of which 25 are women. You know, these are, you know, entrepreneurs of, you know, literally all of the and you're not seeing it. So it's very hard for women. And actually what's fascinating is women start businesses in Ireland at the same rate as men. So the startups are the same. Women are nearly always starting a business to solve a childcare problem. So they're going from a full-time role in a big tech company out into a contracting role so they can facilitate childcare. Not seen at the same level with men. Like my husband is at home tonight minding our baby. It's quite unusual. You know, it's like it's the gender split, it still exists where women, there's a perception. My mum always says the big problem is that the women's movement. So 13 women who kind of, you know, gave us basic rights like contraception. Well done them. You know, it's only 30 years since we got contraception, 35 years. And mum always said the problem was that none of them had babies. So the women's movement, 13 of them, only two of them had kids, obviously because they had time to go and burn their bras and do all of the things. And so it meant we've achieved relative equality until we are 30, 35, 40, whatever time you have your babies, if you have them. And so the bit afterwards, we haven't quite figured out what the gender divide looks like. How do we get women into senior? 1 in 8 women are on boards in Ireland. 1 in 8. Like, you know, just put that in perspective, senior leadership roles. And likewise, you look at the, you know, big accountancy practices, huge challenge. If she has a baby and she's the only one having the damn baby, she's out of work for a year. Her colleague is out of work for 2 weeks. So she's probably losing 2 years of her working career. He's losing 4 weeks. And so until we fix those institutional challenges around paternity leave, like we do extended paternity leave at Tupi, it's so important that we fix this institutional thing so that when you walk into a room, it's really standard to be like, oh yeah, great. You know, 50-50 split is probably going to take our daughter's time, but it will happen. And it'll only happen if we are in the rooms.
My daughter, she's like, I'm a YouTube star. She's 3. And she's like, Mommy, I want to make a YouTube video. Like that, I get excited by that.
That's cool, yeah.
And I would love the people that I work with to have that confidence. Yeah, I'm going to go and do that.
I think there's also a huge challenge. I always think schooling is part of it. So I was homeschooled because I was rather sick when I was little, so I couldn't go to school. So I had the privilege of a really liberal upbringing on top of, because homeschooling is a complicated cup of tea. But it was sort of really liberal upbringing. But it meant that, you know, we tell children when they're 5, they can be anything they want to be in the whole world. We tell them at 10 to start thinking about a sensible career. And by the time they're 15, we're telling them they're genuinely, like their teachers are probably, you're worthless, you were the most disruptive, just, you know, you'll be lucky to be a bin man. And so how does that arc happen through our education? And so of course we are not quite sure. Of course we're not quite certain. And obviously I'm obsessed with female entrepreneurship because it's the world I've come through. But equally, it stands for everyone. And there are people who deserve to be in these rooms. You know, class is another huge one in Ireland that's so prevalent. And so it's worth, yeah, I think the only way we do it is see it, observe it, hand out, you know. John and I were talking earlier about there's so many opportunities to help. You know, this is like James is giving up the evening with his gorgeous little boy and his wife to be here, to be in this room. Likewise, Gary, because we all thought, what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about funding and finance. So if one person listens and think, yeah, I'm going to raise money and I'm going to change the world, that'll be one person more than yesterday.
That's what it's all about. So when does the narrative of the kind of the grey-haired man in the grey-haired suit kind of change from a finance perspective and the challenges female founders face but not being able to maybe be a serial founder and the challenges that have led them not to maybe start multiple businesses? Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, I think so. When you said that, I think one of the points that I made earlier in the podcast was, well, what's the kind of the extra piece that an investor might say that's, you know, really positive from our perspective that gets us over the line? And I think I referenced that, you know, if they have a track record of doing it, that's obviously an extra piece of criteria that's really helpful. And I take your point that if you're at the starting rung of that ladder and you don't have that experience, that kind of nullifies that point in a way. But I think that, you know, there's a lot of supports out there in terms of, you know, the market has become so much more sophisticated in terms of funding, even in the last 5 years, but especially in the last 10 years. Private equity wasn't even a term in the Irish market 10 years ago. It had this kind of connotation of being, these guys with grey hair and grey suits that would strip your business. But the market now, as I say, there's much more pools of capital that's much more accessible to people, I think. And as I said, there's high net worths. There are family offices now that are setting up professional investment vehicles.
there is growth focused funds that focus exclusively on kind of earlier stage businesses. There are private equity, there are venture debt funds. If you're not looking to raise equity, there's guys that can do venture debt and they can structure them in very clever ways. So there's much more, there's a lot more options out there. And there are a lot of, like, there's EWS as well. I know that some of them are in the room here as well. So they're, and they play at different ends of the market too. So I'll go back to the point of, you need to know your audience, you need to know who you're speaking to, what metrics they're typically looking at. And if you have that, that's a really good starting point, because you need all the help you can get, especially at the start when you're at the first rung of that ladder, is the point. But yeah, I understand it is a difficult one, and it is not easy fundraising, especially at the beginning.
And I think it's a great question, Jenny. I think the big thing, so Jenny has been down this road. Jenny 10 years ago was fundraising and done this dance. And I think, you know, let's be clear, the room I sat in where they shook my colleague's hand and told him he'd built a brilliant business, we didn't walk back into that room. And we said, you know, it's like, thanks so much, that's great. Didn't close with them. And so that's, we make our choices. You know, the rooms we were in, the people we closed with, you know, IBI were our partner because they, you know, we presented, the questions went to me. You know, the first questions to me, they went to my team as well. But it's that piece of, you know, you guys understood the vision. It wasn't, you know, you saw no gender. You just saw, that's a company we can work with. And likewise, our partners, you know, BVP, Abbey, PTSB, they were all about the business and the brand. So it's choosing your partners, I think, really helps, you know, qualify out as much as you can possibly can. You know, actually a huge part of why we went to IBI was those early days conversations where I was just like, I do not put me in a room with a bunch of fools again. I'm like, this is like, my time is really precious. We are not doing this dance. We're going to walk into rooms where those conversations have already happened. And I'm sure James had conversations where they were like, oh, diamonds, that's a lovely idea. I never walked into rooms where they're like, oh, that's nice. My least favorite thing in the entire world has been called nice. But I walked in and every room we walked in was about the business, not about me as a founder. And so it's those partnerships that help. And we have to work harder. We will. I stand on the shoulders of the women who came before me, and my daughter will stand on top of mine, because it's the nature of the beast. Yes, it's very challenging, but we do it to make the world better, because we can sit here and go, isn't it great? But if our mothers had sat here and said, isn't it great? And our fathers, we'd be still sitting here with no contraception.
Troopy. I'm going to wrap the live questions.
Sex and contraception, right?
What a way to wrap. But I do want you to thank Troopy Sweetman of Troopy and James Duty from IBI. Please give them a round of applause.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.